Welcome back, campers.
That was Genevieve.
That was Caitlin.
And welcome to episode 74, part 2 of our coverage of the submarine case, the murder of Swedish journalist Kim Wall. Make sure you go back and listen to part 1 first, episode 73, if you're joining us for the first time, obviously. If you've already listened to it, you should have a pretty strong picture by now of Peter Madsen, the eccentric inventor who managed to break the sound barrier with a homemade rocket and enjoyed loaning his submarines out to the porn film industry for reasons only the Dark Lord must know.
Praise Satan. That was a little...
Bring back Sabrina.
Bring back Sabrina the Teenage... Oh, no, the it Chilling just, Adventures yes. of Sabrina. Yes. Bring it back. Sorry, got those confused, but yeah, go watch that show if you haven't. It's awesome.
When we left you in part one, things had gone south hard with Peter's business partner at Copenhagen Suborbitals. So he'd taken up shop next door, literally, and had taken a small group of young interns under his wing who were eager to be part of Rocket Madsen's dreams of submarines and space travel. He also had a secret obsession with actual snuff films of women being beheaded and tortured. But as of this point in our story, no one knew that yet. We're going to jump right back in where we last left off. In the summer of 2017, Peter, who, if you remember, liked to refer to himself as Rocket Madsen, had been granted a permit to launch a rocket into outer space on August 26th, just offshore from the Danish island of Bornholm. It should come as no shock that the space lab he'd been basically fired from next door was also going to be launching their rocket on, surprise, surprise, the very same day. So two rockets.
Yes.
Literally within not even a mile of each other.
Yeah. I don't know if the other place was launching it
at that
in the
spot.
Same place, but yeah, you know it was going to be, they were calling it in articles, the space race of the modern age.
For everyone at home, if you've ever needed a perfect analogy for what a dick swinging match is, there you go.
Literally.
I mean, they're rockets too.
The
so.
Shape, yeah. Literally.
Publicity swirled around the rival rocket launch of both space labs, and he'd begun receiving emails from a tenacious young reporter about an interview. Everyone was shocked when, out of the blue, Peter abruptly postponed the launch of the rocket, and they really didn't understand why. The very next day, on August 10th, 2017, he invited Kim Wall for a submarine dive. Lights out, campers.
Kim Wall was born in the Swedish province of Scania on March 23, 1987, to journalist parents Ingrid and Jacques Wall. Her nickname almost right away was Mumlan, taken from a Swedish phrase for how much she loved to burrow into a cozy blanket. Kim, and very soon after, her little brother Tom, adventured all over the world with Ingrid and Jacques as they chased stories. And Kim was just at home playing under the desks in the newsroom as she was speeding alongside her parents on a train from Germany to Switzerland. Kim had an intense curiosity about everything, and she loved books and stories so much that she even taught herself how to read at 2 years old, because even though her parents read to her every single night, that just wasn't enough. I even read when I was reading a great book that her parents actually wrote about Kim and her life, that when she was a toddler, she was obsessed with dinosaurs. Like, I feel like I've seen that
every
on
kid
social
gravitates
media.
Towards one.
Yes.
I love it.
And it always seems to be like the smart kids that gravitate towards dinosaurs, but she would like make dioramas of like the different periods of Aww. Them and little figurines, and she had a dinosaur backpack and
I love it.
Oh, it's just like so wholesome and so awesome. Kim's imagination was constantly churning, and her empathy for underdogs, whether they were human, plant, or animal, ran very deep from an early age. When Kim was only into kindergarten, she learned that a large copper beech tree on their school's playground was going to be cut down. So she and a friend wrote petitions and made posters to save the beech tree. All her efforts paid off, and that tree is still there to this day.
That's fucking awesome.
Isn't that awesome?
I love that. I love that.
It's so awesome. When Kim was in first grade, the wall spent Kim's winter break traveling all across Australia and snorkeling in the Great Barrier Reef. Kim's teacher had asked if she would draw and write her a book about her trip, and she was so blown away by Kim's book that she kept it for 12 years and later gave it back to Kim on her high school graduation day. This was the kind of tenacity with which Kim took on everything in her life. She was already fluent in English, German, and Spanish, so while she was waiting for her college education to begin at the London School of Economics and Political Science, she rented a bedroom in France and got a waitressing job so that she could study French in her spare time at the Sorbonne. In 2013, Kim won first place in the Foreign Press Association's competition for young journalists. And when she was at LSEPS, that's the short way of saying London School of Economics and Political Science, she didn't just bury her head in the books. She volunteered and mentored other students. She was the secretary for her Nordic Society group, and she arranged trips all over the world. And these were not trips that were like, oh, fun sightseeing trips and yada yada. Mm-hmm. This was like, no, we're going with the intention basically of like developing our journalism skills and doing humanitarian projects. So they were going to like not fun places. Right. They were going to places where you have to not be squeamish and not be a, you know.
Dang.
Yeah.
So she was very type A, I'm hearing.
Very type A. I like that. But also very, a lot of things that I was reading about her was that she had this great sense of humor. Mm-hmm. She was very mischievous. She was very spontaneous. And she was never fussy about anything. If she had an opportunity to go and get a family's life story in a third world country, but she had to like, you know, ride 50 miles in a sketchy bus to get there, she was like, I'm in. Like, that's what
it's she... It's part of the experience.
Yes, yes. And she was not like, oh, you know, rubbing shoulders with fancy rich people in nightclubs. It was very much about real people for her. And despite her, like, high levels of academia, she was also just like, I hate to say a girl's girl, but she was like a person's person, you know, just like a real person.
Even her parents being journalists themselves, she didn't just walk in there like, what's the word? What?
Like, didn't nepo baby.
Yes,
like, didn't
exactly.
just do it because they did it. But they clearly did it in a way that also made her fall in love with it. So
exactly.
It says a lot about their family dynamic and the way that her parents showed her the world. And I think that's also very special.
She had mad respectable drive.
Oh, 100%. And when her formal education was all said and done, Kim not only had a degree from the Sorbonne in Paris, but dual master's degrees in international relations and journalism from the London School of Economics and Columbia University in New York. For the next 4 years, Kim chased stories like each one might be the last on Earth. Like we said before, she had no interest in writing about extravagant nightlife. She wanted to take the dirty buses crammed full of people and help make dinner on someone's swept dirt floor and listen to their life story. She immersed herself in the grim and darker stories like war tourism in Sri Lanka or the torture chambers of Idi Amin in Uganda. But also the ones that fell through the cracks of typical news, like she wrote an article that I told you about this one, Caitlin. Mm-hmm. It somehow made me see furries as more than just this like weird fetish group of weird people and really made me view them in a different light. And it's amazing that she was able to do that
like
with
a proper
her writing.
Light.
Yes, like a proper look at that community.
And I only got the spark notes from you, but like I looked it up and I didn't read the full thing because.
Yeah.
My ADHD doesn't let me do that kind of stuff. But it was, like, really interesting.
Oh, absolutely. She also wrote about how people in Haiti have gone for many years to immense lengths to acquire like bootleg Western entertainment, like TV and music. And that's kind of their way of basically having an escape within that oppressive place that they live. And when she was visiting people there, she was blown away by the fandoms that were far more intense even there than there are in the US, like of Taylor Swift and One Direction and different like anime shows and characters, and how people were like obsessed with Friends and Gilmore Girls and like,
I can only imagine that has to be like fantasy to them. Like,
I mean,
sci-fi almost. It's just a completely different world.
I can't even imagine. But she writes about how there's kind of this network of people who go literally door to door on foot with a preciously protected flash drive where they have acquired bootleg film, shows, music, all kinds of stuff. And they have clients. They like know what certain people prefer. Mm-hmm. And so they acquire these materials for them and they travel on foot to their homes, physically plug the little flash drive into their laptop. They download their things for the week or the month. And it's like a subscription service, but it's run by an actual person on foot with a backpack.
How do I donate like merch?
Literally, though, I was like, that is the most iconic, like rebellious, beautiful thing I've ever heard. It is amazing. And that there, even though it's technically illegal, even the police are like, they don't do anything about it.
You know, they got their own fandoms.
Absolutely, because they're like, who are we to say that you cannot watch How I Met Your Mother? Like,
but
for real, though.
Such a cool concept to write about.
Yeah, it really is. And it's cool to think that she was the kind of person who was like, I'm going to go get boots on the ground and go kind of like bring that. I mean, here we're in, what, 2025 and we're talking about it now because she went and like investigated it and wrote a piece about it. So,
and I wouldn't consider it the white saverism type thing.
Yeah, absolutely not. I mean, she wasn't doing anything but being like, can I come alongside you and just watch what you're doing and tell what you're doing? And that in and of itself is true journalism. Ooh. Now, by 2017, so she's only 30 at this point, Kim was on the cusp of a permanent place among the world's top-tier journalists, and she had an impending move to Beijing with her partner, Ola. And the pieces she would be writing there were certain to solidify that position in her career. And all she had left to do was her going away party with Ola and their friends, but also getting this one last interview with that quirky little inventor with a dream to be the first private person in space, Peter Madsen.
On Friday, August 11th, 2017, at 5:31 a.m., Kim's mother, Ingrid, was yanked out of a deep sleep by the ring of a telephone. It was Kim's partner, Ola. His voice was shaky as he forced out the words, "Kim has disappeared from a submarine near Copenhagen." At this point, Ola had already been to hell and back. What had supposed to be a quick 2-hour detour from he and Kim's evening with friends to celebrate their upcoming move to Beijing had turned into Ola frantically calling Kim's cell phone over and over. Hours passed since they were supposed to have surfaced, and she never came home. Ola had even called and woken up the wife of Peter Madsen, but she didn't know anything. He'd called the police and the Coast Guard and lit a fire under their asses to take immediate action. Ola and now Ingrid, her brother Tom, and her father Jacques had the full weight of dread sinking in that their beloved Kim was trapped in a submarine somewhere in the deep waters of Copenhagen's Øresund Strait. And if that was the case, it would be rapidly running out of oxygen. Coast Guard boats and helicopters began combing the wide expanse of water, and the top story in every Swedish news broadcast was that a journalist, along with an inventor and a submarine, were missing. Ingrid, Jacques, and Ola raced over to Rocket Madsen Space Lab, where they found Peter's handful of young interns pacing with radios and walkie-talkies and looking every bit as anxious and frantic as the walls felt. Suddenly, a phone call came in that the submarine had been found and everyone was fine. Relief flooded the walls for the briefest moment, but then a second call. The submarine had sunk, and only one person had been rescued. The walls floored it to the city of Dragor, where media and law enforcement were swarming the harbor, and as they pulled up, they could make out the dim silhouette of the man Kim had boarded the submarine with, sitting in the back of a police car. Earlier, he'd been filmed giving a cheerful smile and a thumbs up to the cameras pointed at the Coast Guard boat bringing him to the shore. Of course, he hadn't harmed Kim, he told authorities. Yes, they dove down in the Nautilus for a couple of hours Thursday evening, but, you know, then he'd let her off on a dock at the outermost tip of Ref Shale Island and continued on his own. When the Nautilus began taking on water and he had to radio for help. This didn't make any sense. Then why hadn't anyone heard from Kim? Odd, but not entirely impossible given the nature of her job. When her friends were texting amongst themselves, one of them even joked that she was probably off doing a story on some weird sex cult and would pop back up with an amazing story in her pocket.
That sounds like the comment of people being like, you know, they're like, oh, like, it's not good. No one's heard from her, but they're not like worried.
Like, or she, you know, she's known to do like kind of wander.
Yeah. Like she's probably just off chasing a story.
And again, the first thing you think of isn't she's been murdered.
Yeah.
You know?
Unless you're us. And
yes.
But it makes total sense for them to have that reaction at first.
Mm-hmm.
But over the next handful of hours, the shell-shocked walls found themselves in a drab police questioning room, being asked all about Kim's work and her mental state and her relationship with Ola, willing someone to come in the room and declare that it was all just a big misunderstanding and Kim was fine. They had been supposed to be spending the weekend in Berlin to celebrate their wedding anniversary. But now they sat in the station waiting room clutching cups of vending machine coffee, and a headline blared across the TV hanging from the wall. Peter Madsen was now under arrest for the death of Swedish journalist Kim Wall. Essentially, all other news stopped, and Kim's face was the breaking story everywhere. At a closed hearing in Copenhagen, Peter Madsen explained that, yes, he didn't want to upset the family initially, but Kim had in fact died in a tragic accident. She'd been following him up the steps of the UC-3 Nautilus into its tower when the heavy metal hatch had fallen on her head, and the blow had unfortunately killed her instantly. He himself had gone into shock and fell asleep for several hours while the Nautilus was still submerged. Once he'd awakened, he decided the best thing to do would be to, massive air quotes, bury Kim at sea, according to an old sailor tradition, and so he had done so in Koga Bay. Okay.
Massive get fucked, Peter.
Massive get fucked. First of all, this story already made no sense. Peter and Kim had been just offshore of a large city surrounded by all sorts of maritime traffic. Why wouldn't he have just radioed for help the moment there had been any sort of accident? It was also pretty weird that once the sunken Nautilus had been pulled up from the bottom of Øresund and drained of over 9,000 gallons of water, police discovered that the submarine appeared to have been sunk intentionally. There was some blood on the inside of the submarine, but no sign of Kim, and at this point they didn't even know if that actually was her blood or not. Tips came flooding into police that multiple people had seen Kim smiling from the tower of the Nautilus as it floated out from the harbor, but after the text she sent to Ola around 8:30 p.m., no one had seen or heard from her. The waiting for answers as search teams combed the waters along both sides of Øresund was agony for Kim's family and Ola. They weren't blind to the fact that Kim's work could regularly thrust her into dangerous situations. But this, she was only 45 minutes from her mom and dad's house, practically in her hometown, and Kim was smart. She'd been through serious self-defense and hostage training, and she'd even been mugged several times when she was chasing stories in developing countries. One of her close friends even said to a media source that Kim, in particular, was both very book and street smart, and that, quote, "it would be really strange if someone actually managed to get the better of her." In the days that followed, Kim's friends and colleagues descended on the Walls' home to shower them with food and wine and memories of Kim. They took Ingrid and Jacques' dog, Iso, out for walks on the beach and spent evenings huddled together on the couch, weeping and laughing and swapping stories about Kim. The search for Kim was still in full force, but every day that passed left less room for hope that somehow Peter Madsen had been lying and Kim would be found alive.
On Monday, August 21st, 2017, a cyclist was biking along the southern shore of the island of Amager, where Kastrup Airport is located, when they came upon a nude human body washed up along the shoreline. Jacques and Ingrid's phone rang, and it was Detective Jens Møller Jensen. That's a fun name. Sorry.
It sounds like a definitely like a crime show name. Jens Møller Jensen.
Detective Jens Møller Jensen to confirm the worst. The body was Kim's. But it wasn't her whole body. It was only her torso, and it had been violently stabbed at least 15 times, with the majority of the stab wounds concentrated in her pelvic area. A strap with metal weights had also been wrapped tightly around the torso in a failed attempt to keep it from rising to the surface. The police expanded the charges against Peter Madsen to indecent handling of a corpse. 4 days later, hundreds of people gathered at night to walk through the streets of Copenhagen, clutching torches and roses in honor of Kim's memory. They finished at the edge of the sea and all together cast their roses into the ocean.
That's like hauntingly beautiful. Mm. That's as horrific as everything happening now is. The two things that we've mentioned so far, just about the way that people just kind of flooded their home and were like, we're here, we have food and wine, and we're just gonna like sit and hold each other and talk about her. And then like, mom and dad of Kim, we're taking your dog out to the beach, you know, just that beautiful display of love and community says so much about truly who she was and who her parents were, and the walking at night with the torch. It's just, there's something special about her and her family, that the way that so many people, I think, are a reflection of their life is how people tend to respond to their death. Not always, because I don't want to put everyone like under the same, paint everything with the same brush, but you see what I'm saying in this case is just like that she was beloved,
right?
And her family was beloved, and you
while
just
they're mourning her, obviously they are like this community, like you said, are coming together to celebrate the life that she had.
Yes.
And
yes,
to do that I think is truly special. And
yeah,
I mean, I got chills.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
2 weeks later, a second court hearing was held, and Peter Madsen ordered to be detained another 4 weeks, during which he would undergo a forensic psychiatric health examination, and police would have full access to his computer. At his own request, Peter was allowed to speak, and somehow, he managed to drag out everything he'd already said for 4 fucking hours.
Oh my god. That should be a criminal charge in and of itself somehow.
Gosh.
Charge for wasting
the court's
time.
People go to these hearings, like, just random people to hear, and I get it, like, especially this one.
Like, yeah, because it's so high profile.
To listen to him.
Ugh.
And he did that while also talking a ton about his sexual preferences.
And that should be another criminal charge. Like, what? As if that wasn't bad enough. So now that, you know, the investigation is in full force, there's like bazillions of articles everywhere all the time, and the walls being journalists themselves are even more kind of thrust into the spotlight.
Mm-hmm.
Kim's mom writes in the book that they wrote about Kim's life and the case, just some of the things that she remembered as being like, what the actual fuck, when all of this was going on. And one of them was a journalist literally asking her if they could have a funeral for Kim if they hadn't found all of her body parts yet. What is wrong with people? I don't even know how to respond to that. But another one was, there was a Danish newspaper that published an article with like an illustration,
mm-hmm.
and Peter and Kim were depicted as Lego figures on like a Lego submarine. And again, they were just like, why? That's just so weird and like disrespectful. And like, they were trying to be darkly humorous or something, yeah. but that's just in such poor taste. So there was that. And then of course, everywhere that they look, they have to see Peter's like stupid quote saying that her death was an accident and that he'd given her an at-sea burial. And
again, God. What the fuck do you mean by that?
Yeah, it doesn't even make sense, because you're saying that, but we have her torso. Yeah.
If she died by accident, you're not a fucking sailor. This isn't like the olden times.
No.
What do you mean? Like, that was what your brain went through, the process of what?
Like, you're not on like the last voyage of the fucking Demeter where you're never going to see land again. Like, I'm sorry. No.
Again, you were just off the fucking shore. I'm sorry. I'm going to drop a lot of F-bombs because I truly don't understand.
Yeah. It's just makes you just so enraged. In hindsight, for her family, and the strength I can't even imagine that they tapped into to get through all of this bullshit while literally looking for their daughter. I have nothing but the highest degree of respect for her family.
It was now October 6, 2017, a full 2 months after Kim's disappearance. Dogs and helicopters and boats had not recovered anything since the discovery of Kim's torso, so it was time for a last resort. Over the course of 2 days, a Danish diving team performed multiple dives of Kogi Bay. On the morning of the first day, they found a bag containing a shirt, a skirt, socks, and shoes. Without a doubt, they were the clothes that Kim had boarded the Nautilus wearing. The bag also contained a knife and lead weights to ensure it stayed down. Around noon, the dive team recovered a severed leg, and then a second leg, both found at the bottom of the bay. A few minutes later, they pulled up another bag that had been weighed down with several pieces of metal. This bag contained Kim Wall's severed head. Finally, after 111 days, all of Kim's body had been found. And contrary to what Peter Madsen had originally claimed, that Kim had tragically and accidentally died when the submarine's heavy hatch fell down onto her head, there was absolutely zero sign of a skull fracture or any other signs of blunt force trauma to her head.
Like, you dumbass, you did not think that A, you didn't think they were going to find her, and B, you really didn't think that wouldn't be the first thing that they would look for.
I not to play devil's advocate, because he, mm-hmm. I believe he was of sound mind, but like, he's so in his own little world of like, it's truly the Peter show.
Yeah.
He's so like blinded by things that, I mean, I can't imagine he truly cared for simple facts. And
I think you're exactly right, because that's a very telling thing of when somebody, just from everything I have read, obviously not an expert here, but when somebody is living out an intense fantasy,
exactly.
like a sociopathic or psychopathic like fantasy,
mm-hmm.
they kind of have blinders on, and the only reality then is the fantasy, and mm-hmm. they can't think beyond it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very like tracking with that
I feel like in cases that we've read, I feel like the smart ones are truly the dumb ones.
Mm-hmm.
They are so sure of themselves,
mm-hmm.
and so like I said, in their world, mm-hmm. of like, they're the greatest, that they just lose sight of reality, like you said.
Yeah, and there's no doubt that he wasn't, like, book smart, intelligent, and if you don't break the sound barrier with a rocket without having some pistons firing correctly right. out there. But there was a heck of a lot of them that clearly were not hitting the mark.
When police confronted Mattson with their findings, it seemed to jog his memory. They were right. He had lied, after all, about the submarine hatch falling on Kim's head. But wait, the truth was, hold on, give him a second. The truth was,
oh, it's coming back to him now.
The truth was, she had been killed by carbon monoxide poisoning from a leak that happened in one of the rooms below deck. Unfortunately, Kim had somehow managed to lock herself in this room while she was exploring the sub. Peter, being the hero that he was, had tried desperately to give Kim instructions on how she could reopen the door. But she was just too panicked, and by the time he had been able to get her out himself, it was too late. Mm-hmm. And so then you stripped her, mutilated her body, mm-hmm. and then you were like, yeah.
Weighted it down with weights, and then to make sure in your mind that no one would ever find her again. If you really were, let's just say, for shits and giggles, that wannabe hero of a tragic accident and you tried to save her, everything you did would be the opposite of what a sane person would do. So you're just embarrassing yourself at this point. And this is also yet again why we couldn't be detectives, Caitlin, because I would have flipped the desk in his face.
I just would have been making a face at him like, are you fucking stupid? Like, and I swear, he just wants to hear his own voice. Ugh.
Honestly. But even still, if somehow Kim's death was an accident, the question remained, why did Peter dismember her? We are so sorry. This is absolutely vile and disgusting. But according to Peter, when he was asked this, he said, quote, if you have a big problem, you have to divide it into smaller pieces. Get fucked, Peter Mattson.
Like, oh, that's sickening. You're talking about a person, not a math equation.
Yeah.
Not a bunch of cardboard boxes that you need to fit into your recycling bin.
Ugh. Unforgivable. Oh my gosh. By now, the charges against Peter had been expanded to include, quote, sexual crimes under particularly aggravating circumstances. Yes, Peter Mattson is aggravating. Astoundingly, people within earshot of the walls during this time had the unbelievable audacity to ask questions like why Kim had been wearing the skirt that was found in the bag of her clothing at the bottom of the bay on the submarine. I'm not even going to bother breaking that down because...
If you also have that question, please log out of whatever you're listening on and stop following us.
This is not the podcast for you.
Oh.
A prominent Danish journalist, and rightly so, was also put on blast when he wrote an article in a major Danish magazine implying that women like Kim who play with fire are going to get burned. Apparently, he was put on blast so hard that he recanted the article.
Doesn't work that way.
No. Another Swedish paper wrote an article entitled, quote, Life of Murder Suspect Mattson in Shambles, Denied Visitors to His Cell, Wife Has Left Him, quote. And to that we say, good.
Hear, hear.
Mm-hmm. Peter Madsen's trial began on March 8th, 2018, and he was arraigned on three charges, premeditated murder, aggravated sexual assault, and desecrating a corpse. The following are some key moments broken down from this agonizing trial. One, like we mentioned before, it was discovered that Peter Mattson was really into snuff films. After searching his computer, police found multiple videos of real people, especially women, being literally murdered. He also had tons of porn searches, and the top three words in these porn searches were throat, girl, and pain. Peter's preferred method of torture in these videos appeared to be whenever a woman was being tortured with a knife, fire, or a spear.
And this is where we kink shame.
Yeah, this is 100% where we say, if this is your kink, get help immediately. That is not a kink, that is a criminal pathology.
Mm-hmm.
And number two. Several hours before Kim boarded the submarine on August 10th, Peter had literally Googled, quote, beheaded girl agony, which he claimed to the court was just, quote, pure coincidence. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Number three, Peter had changed his story multiple times, like when he first claimed that he returned Kim to land alive and well. And then he said, oh, wait, no, she actually died when the hatch fell on her head. And then he said, oh, wait, no, actually, she died of accidental asphyxiation. So he's established himself as a completely unreliable person to police, and that really is gonna fuck you in a trial. Number four. Peter also told the court that he had lied initially just to protect Kim's family from the details of her death, and he kept lying every time the police unearthed new evidence, and he had to make a whole new explanation, and kind of said the same thing already, but he just did this so much that nothing he said could be trusted, so they can't even, like, follow leads that he gives them or, like, follow up on anything he says because, like, he's just, why are you lying?
why the fuck are you lying?
Ugh. And a five. And this, to me, is easily one of the most absolutely terrifying. Peter Madsen had invited another woman to go on board the sub with him and do a dive before Kim. This unnamed witness actually testified in court that Peter had invited her onto his submarine soon after they met by chance back in May 2017, and she had declined. But he contacted her again online and asked her to go again on August 8th, just 2 days before Kim got on the sub. She said, quote, I thought it was a little odd that he wrote to me. If it had been my submarine, I would not have invited me when I didn't answer the first time. Oh, God.
Common sense.
Common sense. So what this did to the court was definitely make Peter look like he was trying to lure someone onto the sub, which equals premeditation.
All and there's caps. The math equation. That's the answer, that the equation.
Sign, seal, bah, deliver, bah. Bing, bang, bada boom, done. I don't even know, Caitlin, if this is the same woman that is in the documentary and Into the Deep.
I think it's in the same because that girl, her name was out there, I believe.
Okay.
And she...
They didn't meet by chance. She worked with him. If I'm wrong about this, I'll have it taken out, but I am 99.9% certain that not only were they friends, they were actually former lovers because, you know, he was in an open marriage. He swung. And
she was
really cute. Yeah. So, like, and he's really smart and, you know, they have this similar interest. So it seems as though at one point they were romantically connected. Again, not this person, but anyways.
But yes, this girl is a completely separate girl than was in the Netflix documentary.
Yes, I believe so.
And that's a whole nother freaking rabbit hole.
A whole nother can of fucked up worms. But what it shows us is that Kim wasn't the only one, obviously, who got asked to go on. This woman wasn't the only one. And he had taken other women previously on the submarine. Because remember, in episode one, we talked about that, how he would meet women at parties and would invite them. And they would, you know, do BDSM stuff together. So this was like his normal MO. You know, he wanted to get women to go on the submarine with him.
Well, I know you didn't write it in this, but I do think it's worth mentioning. The woman who is in the Netflix documentary was messaging him and whatnot. And he, like, in those messages, described murdering her. Like, she was like, she had asked, like, threaten me so I can get to work. Like, it was just playful joking, whatever. And he's like, I will murder you.
You are Absolutely right. I can't believe I forgot about that. So yes, let's make sure we mention that. So y'all, I don't even know if this officially was put into court record or not, but there is a documentary that we've referenced in these two episodes called Into the Deep. And there is someone who was a colleague, friend, and we believe former lover of Peter Madsen, who was working on his projects with him at Rocket Madsen Space Labs. She speaks in this documentary about a text exchange that happens between them where she's working late. She's trying to get work done. They have this kind of like fun banter-y, you know, texting relationship. And she's like, oh, I've got to get this work done, but I'm so tired, basically, like, which I think this is weird in and of itself, but she's like, give me some death threats so I don't leave until the work gets done. And boy, does he ever. He then is like, I'm creeping up behind you. Yes. I'm putting a rope around your neck. I'm doing all this. And it gets really creepy and really dark. And she's like, oh, ha ha ha. Like, okay, I'm good to go now.
And needless to say, she didn't go on the sub with him.
Yeah. So, oh my God, I can't believe I forgot about that. But yeah, that was unhinged.
So again, premeditation by trying to lure a random girl, like you said. And then all the Google searches he's done. Mm-hmm. Not normal.
Yeah.
And then he literally texted what he would do. Like, as a massive air quote joke.
As a ha ha joke? No, sir. So this was not in any way, shape, or form targeting Kim Wall specifically. Mm-hmm. He just wanted to get a woman out there because he has this escalating, what I believe is an addiction, a fantasy that isn't being fulfilled anymore by what he's watching.
Right.
So he has to actually now, in his mind, I'd say has to, you have a choice, but he, to get that same level of rush and thrill, he's like, well, I'm going to do it for real.
Even like control, like
with
having to do the rocket and compete with your former worker, like the stress he's under, I guess. And he's just like, I need control. And that's what, like, and then, I mean, it's, while I don't recommend the Netflix documentary because it shines so much light on Peter himself, I do recommend it in this sense that, like, some of the clips when he's doing the interview with Emily.
Yes, I believe that's her name.
Who was originally doing the documentary before he did all this shit. And he gets the text, like, from Kim, like, saying, and he got up, he stopped talking, he got distracted, said.
He's very, like, scattered and very skittish, and it's very weird. Yeah, if you guys are very interested in Peter Madsen's pathology and just kind of, like, trying to spot the red flags, this truly is 90% just documentary footage of him. And I think, not to bash them too much, I think that's kind of the point of it, is they're putting it out there being like, this is the person we were filming and we didn't see this coming.
Yes.
So please learn from this so that maybe you can see it coming with other people. And when you approach it from that angle, I think, you know, there's a little bit more value in it as like a true crime consumer.
We're not sensationalizing a killer.
Right, right. But it is fascinating. Ooh. And just blech.
Blech.
Finally, the last little highlight, I feel bad saying highlight, nasty low light that came out of this trial leading to Peter's conviction was what sources called Peter's, quote, worrying description of Kim's actual dismemberment when he had to talk about it. So on the stand, Peter literally admitted dismembering Kim using, quote, what was around in his submarine. Then, during questioning by the prosecution, he described the literal dismembering of Kim's body as a, quote, insane situation. He told the court that he had dismembered her in the bathroom on board his submarine and said, quote, it's something so horrible that I do not want to go into detail. I will just say that it was horrible. Quote, it will come as no shock to anyone that after all of this, plus his official psychiatric assessment, court psychiatrists determined that Peter Madsen, quote, showed a severe lack of empathy and remorse and was extremely untrustworthy and a pathological liar with psychopathic tendencies. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Your Honor. No further comment.
Mm-hmm. Coroner Christina Jacobson told the court that there was, quote, no conclusive evidence to prove the cause of death beyond doubt due to the amount of time her body was left submerged in water, but it was believed that Kim was most likely strangled or had her throat cut. Also, it should be noted, no traces of soot or carbon monoxide were found on board the submarine to give any credence to Peter's bogus suffocation story.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
When he was asked about stab wounds all over Kim's torso and pelvis, Peter said, quote, I pierced certain parts of her body because I did not want them to be inflated by gas, and that there was nothing erotic in those blows.
Get fucked.
Now, in Denmark, at least when Peter's sentence was handed down, a life sentence for murder was typically a max of 12 to 16 years. However, in certain cases, it would be possible for a convicted murderer to remain in custody for life if he or she was deemed too dangerous to be released. I'm gonna file him under that.
Yeah.
So, finally, on April 25th, 2018, Peter Madsen was convicted of all three charges against Kim Wall and sentenced to life imprisonment. In September of that same year, he appealed the sentence, and it was denied.
God, if I was the judge, I would have slammed that denied.
I would have been like, why are you wasting my time? Get out of my sight.
Sit the fuck down.
And just as Peter Madsen, POS prison epilogue, in August 2018, Madsen was admitted to hospital after being attacked in prison by an 18-year-old inmate. Then, in 2020, Peter briefly escaped from prison by threatening a prison employee by using a pistol-like object, before fleeing while wearing an object he claimed was a bomb belt. I mean, Pee-wee Gaskins had a bomb in prison, so you know.
Pee-wee Gaskins shook the foundation of that prison with the bomb he created. This was no real bomb belt, though. It was just some dumb shit he put together and was like, I'm going to blow this place up.
I mean, but you know what? If mad rocket scientist Madsen was in prison and he told me he MacGyvered some shit, yeah. I would be inclined to believe.
Yeah. And you don't know who he did that to.
Exactly.
It could have been a janitor and they'd been like, this is above my pay grade.
Yeah, they're like, not today, babe.
Yeah.
The bomb squad was deployed and Madsen was surrounded and apprehended by police 500 meters. 547 yards.
Thank you.
From the prison and then taken back into custody. He is currently serving a for real life sentence in the high security.
Sorry, this is going to be a bitch to pronounce. Storstrøm.
In the high security Storstrøm prison in Denmark. Good riddance.
Yes.
Ugh.
Holy God. Now, how are we going to wrap this up after all of that horrible Peter Madsen shenanigans? Well, let's talk about Kim.
Let's talk about Kim.
Yes. To be the kind of storyteller that Kim was, you have to be fearless. To be the kind of person she was, you have to have a heart that sees the good in people. Whether he deserved it or not, Kim even saw good in Peter Madsen. And so did the many other people who worked with him, who believed he was their friend. And that's something that doesn't really get talked about a lot, is the betrayal, obviously the ultimate betrayal of taking Kim's life. Mm-hmm. But there are some moments in footage that I watched where these young people, it's, you know, like young college age looking men and a couple young women who have been kind of taken under Peter Madsen's wing, mm-hmm. and are working for him at Rocket Madsen Space Labs. And they were already filming their process of building the rocket. So they kind of had their own little documentary thing going. And mm-hmm. when Peter and Kim don't come back from their submarine ride, they film themselves waiting for the news to come in, mm-hmm. and kind of like as that situation is developing, and the genuine devastation and just betrayal and grief and anger
yeah.
that you see wash over them is heartbreaking, because they kind of seem like they gave everything they had to this dream that he had, and in one fell swoop it all fell apart because it was revealed who he really was. And I honestly, my heart goes out to them as well, because I yeah. really hope that they got help and that they're okay. And just another fuck Peter Madsen for what they did.
Truly one of my biggest fears is like somebody in my life, especially somebody close to me, one day being revealed as like not like, the person that they showed me.
Like your trusted inner circle.
Like that, the thought of that guts me.
Yeah. How do you ever trust someone again? And he betrayed them. Mm-hmm. But the fact that he betrayed all of these people was no one's fault but Peter's own. Peter would often say to his team at the Madsen Space Lab that, quote, they were either going down in history as the greatest heroes or the greatest criminals. Well, to Peter, we'd say, you're definitely not going down in history as the greatest of anything. All you'll be going down as is nothing. Prison is where Peter Madsen's story ends. But Kim's death was not the end of her story. Through her work, her voice remains bright and clear, and her tenacity as a journalist will keep the bar held high for countless young women who follow in her footsteps. Anyone who knew Kim saw how she felt a deep empathy for people who the world had swept aside into dark corners, and how her writing blazed the brightest of lights on their humanity. One of Kim's professors at Columbia beautifully remembered her as being alive in ways that most people can only dream of being alive. And as we combed through dozens of moving tributes written about Kim by her friends and family, and we looked for just the right quote to conclude this episode, we realized something. Maybe the best way we can truly honor Kim is by letting her take center stage. Nearly 10 years after Kim's passing, her mother Ingrid opened Kim's laptop and came across a document tucked away in a file that she'd never seen before. In it was a short piece, never published, written by 22-year-old Kim on the 20th anniversary of the falling of the Berlin Wall, on a cold gray November evening in 2009. And she found herself surrounded on all sides by all manner of people gathered to celebrate the preciousness of freedom. As a gift to those who knew Kim, and to those of us who wish we could have known her, her family chose to include that piece in the book, A Silenced Voice, The Life of Journalist Kim Wall. Her brother Tom said of Kim that, for most people, the phrase goes, the pen is mightier than the sword. But Kim's pen was her sword. The following are her words. When I arrive at the Brandenburg Gate, it seems like most of the expected visitors, several hundred thousand, are already here. I'm pulled into a group only about 50 meters from the stage where the Berlin Wall stood two decades before, just a few minutes before the celebration of the anniversary is to begin. I'm already soaked through from the autumn rain falling, but two Frenchmen hold an umbrella over my head. Right in front of me, there are barricades and policemen, there to block the way to the stage. For reasons of safety, they don't want to let people into this area, something that seems ridiculous given the large empty space between us and the stage. After all, this is not a day one should be building walls. Happily chanting the slogan from 1989, "Wir sind ein Volk," we are one people, the comrades around me break down the provisional fence, and their running feet are accompanied by laughter. It all happens in the blink of an eye, and the police can hardly object. As I rush with them in what one could consider my first act of civil disobedience, I get a feeling that something similar happened the same night exactly 20 years ago. Just on a much larger scale.
Somehow, I make my way to the Brandenburg Gate, where the speakers line up after the Berlin Philharmonic has performed. Hillary Clinton, Angela Merkel, Gordon Brown, Dmitry Medvedev, Nicolas Sarkozy, Lech Walesa, all of them here except Obama, who instead sends his congratulations through a direct broadcast speech from the White House, projected on gigantic TV screens. The air is full of mist from the rain and the excitement. Being here feels something like standing right under the stage at a rock concert, only much more intense. The most significant speaker is maybe Mikhail Gorbachev, the Soviet leader who in 1987 was directly encouraged by Reagan to, quote, tear down this wall, and who was responsible for introducing Glasnost, a necessary step towards the fall of the Iron Curtain. Behind me, 1,000 unique human-sized domino bricks are placed in a line, all decorated by children, artists, and poets from all over the world. They form a symbolic wall, and they reach from the Potsdamer Platz past the Brandenburg Gate and up to the Reichstag. The final speaker is José Manuel Barroso, president of the European Commission, who has the honor of toppling the first domino brick. When they fall one by one, there are a few eyes that are still dry. The cries of hurrah from thousands of people are accompanied by fireworks.
The American girls at my left asked me to take their picture in front of the Brandenburg Gate while Hillary Clinton is speaking. Meanwhile, the Frenchmen to my right hug each other and ask me if I want to share their cigar. Pour la liberté. Around me, I can see African and Asian people next to many Germans, each with his or her own story to tell about the wall. We all truly have good reason to celebrate the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Has a human structure ever had such a symbolic significance before? The wall didn't just divide a city, a nation, and its people, but signaled an ever-growing gap between East and West. When it fell, the Iron Curtain was, and still is, a victory for people all over the globe. It represents basic human rights, democracy, and the immediate need for a grassroots revolution. The fall of the wall was caused more by people than by political decisions. These values, important for us all, are even more important for those who are still closed behind barricades in other parts of the world. The Great Firewall in China, which censors the internet, the 2,500-mile barrier between India and Bangladesh that runs through villages and even through houses, and, most notably, our generation's Berlin Wall, the Israeli barricade on the West Bank. All of these still exist today. These physical and psychological walls, just as many others, will appear less and less justifiable in light of what happened during this weekend's festivities. Maybe the large sums of money spent on this Fest der Freiheit, Festival of Freedom, are the most wisely used this side of the recession. Everything that can harass and force these decision-makers into a new era of glasnost by showing the absurdity of the antiquated model of artificial partitioning has to cost money.
By coincidence, I was actually here in Germany 20 years ago. I wasn't in Berlin, so I missed the sight of family, friends, and lovers who fell into each other's arms, and soldiers who laid down their Kalashnikovs to open champagne bottles together with the jubilant masses. Since I was only 2½, I don't remember anything of what I actually saw. A massive stream of East Germans who came over to the West to enjoy their newly won freedoms. This included getting to wear clothes in colors other than gray and brown and blue, and to eat bananas every day. Individual freedom can only find space in such small things like these. After having witnessed and shared the uninhibited joy on November 9, 1989, I'm not sure I can experience this feeling, although 2 decades have passed. It's probably too much for a young person like me, born and raised in Sweden, a land with one of the planet's longest traditions of democracy, to understand. The most crucial thing in recognizing historic events such as this is allegorical. By celebrating 20 years of a unified Germany, we can put the Iron Curtain into a context.
In addition, it's a perfect opportunity to recognize the situation of people who live segregated and oppressed in other places. This, rather than celebrating the historic turning point, is why the world's leaders are here today. It is for the individuals who live behind these remaining walls that these festivities are so significant. The Berlin Wall is fundamentally a metaphor that tells us that it is possible and necessary to tear down walls for people who are less fortunate than the citizens of Berlin. Kim Wall, November 2009, 22 years old.
If you'd like to read more of Kim's pieces and learn how you can contribute to the Kim Wall Memorial Fund supporting the work of female journalism around the world, please, please, please visit rememberingkimwall.com. Thanks for coming along with us today, campers. We'll meet you all back at the same time next week. And until then, have courage and stay kind.
Of a bitch.
Bye!